Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
This episode is brought to you by The Sinner. From executive producer Jessica Biel, The Sinner is a limited series event that begins with an unsettling and heart-wrenching crime, parents murdered by their young son. But the sins of a child are never his alone, and beneath the surface of a seemingly normal small town lie very dark secrets. You will know who, you will know how, but you won't believe why. Bill Pullman, Carrie Coon, and Tracy Letts star. The Sinner returns with a new story Wednesday, August 1st at 10, 9 central on USA Network.
Wind Gap. There was a murder there. Another one's missing now. Get me a story.
Bad Mama, goodness, I didn't expect you. The house is not up to par for visitors. I'm just in town on business.
What kind of person does that? Hurt a child.
Doesn't help anything. Riling folks up.
You got two mutilated girls on your hands. Someone else is doing the riling.
I didn't come back to cause any problems. Everything you do comes back on me.
Mama says I need to be careful around you. Are you dangerous?
Hello and welcome to Still Watching Sharp Objects, an unofficial podcast about the HBO series Sharp Objects. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
Each week we break down the latest episode and occasionally feature interviews with the people who worked on the show itself. This week we have an amazing conversation between Richard and the lovely Elizabeth Perkins, who plays Jackie on the show. We're also doing something a little different with this series that we're covering, Still Watching, because there is a book that goes along with the show. We have a little book reader spoiler section at the end of the episode. We've had a few questions, complaints, comments, concerns about the way in which we let you know that we are going into spoilers or how much we will be spoiling. So let me just say right now, we will spoil everything and anything in that spoiler section. So if you are in there in that section at the end of the episode, you're in there at your own risk. That being said, we're going to do a little bit better job this week of letting you know that we're in the spoiler section by including some kind of sound effect. I'm hoping for pig sounds. Richard, do you have any hopes?
I'm hoping for pigs. And I think, you know, we should apologize because I guess we had been saying we're moving into the spoiler section in a sort of Patricia Clarkson purr, and we should have been more loud about it because some people were not happy. And also, yes, stressing also that we will be discussing literally whodunit. So if you don't want to know that, or steer clear.
But I also know we did get some emails from people who were like, because I kind of called out in the spoiler section last week that I knew that there would be some people listening to the spoiler section who hadn't read the books. And I got some email from people being like, yep, I'm one of those people who hasn't read the books, but listened to the spoiler section. And like for some people, like a murder mystery of whodunit, like they actually prefer to know who did it because then they are like less anxious about it. So, you know, if you want to join us in the spoiler section, feel free, whether you've read the books or not, but be warned, we will talk about everything and anything. So, Before we get to that, before we get to your emails, I just want to say that we will be in the non-spoiler section discussing everything leading up to episode 4, Ripe, directed by Jean-Marc Vallée, written by Vince Calandra Jr. We do have a pair of listener emails that I wanted to just dip into really quickly. You can always email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. That's stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. And the first email comes from Samantha, who pointed out something that I hadn't, a connection that I hadn't made in previous episode fix. She says, one thing you pointed out helped me build a connection to a previous episode, the lipstick. You noted how Camille is quoting her mother without ever quite believing it as she tells Alice about how to apply lipstick. And it made me think of the episode where young Camille sees her sister at the funeral. Young Camille becomes fixated on wiping the lipstick off her sister's corpse, which I now see as an act of defiance against the picturesque child her mother tried to create. I hadn't thought about that. There's also, I think, a moment before Camille goes to the house in the very first place. She puts lipstick on. And so, yeah, this idea of femininity as dictated by Adora, I think, is an interesting through line of the show.
And of course, there's that famous Wind Gap saying, you can put lipstick on a hog,
but it'll still be hot.
Exactly.
Exactly. There's also this question of hair length and femininity. We got that. We returned to it a little bit in this episode, but we got to hear about how Anne Nash, sort of in defiance of her mom wanting to put her hair up and curl her, sort of like chopped all her hair off. And we see in the flashbacks, we see Camille both with long wavy hair and with short cropped hair. So this idea of if you, I know there's a section in the book where she talks about, like, if you're a true Wind Gap girl, you have your hair curling all the way down your back, which we see in a lot of the young women, including like Emma and her two friends and stuff like that. So like for a girl to cut her hair off is a huge act of rebellion in Wind Gap. So. And then we got an email from Natalie Muskin Press, who, I believe is, said she's a psychiatrist. She's a therapist. And so is far more qualified than you or I, Richard, to talk about some of the
how dare you
psychological.
I have been in therapy for years.
The one thing she said, it's a great long email. I'll just pull out a couple points. One of my favorite ones that she mentions is, she says, the first thing I want to praise about the show is how well they visualize the experience of being triggered. The images, relationships, emotions, and everything. The warm embrace Camille has with Emma that leads to the hint of a sister relationship she had with Alice that ties back to her relationship with the sick Marion. The flash of a clear leg. The image of a girl leaving a doorway. The toilet. Just the general emotional feeling of being out of control. We get that in this episode. There's something with a bug. Like, I read this email and then I watched this episode again, and there's this moment with a bug in episode 4, Ripe, that sends Camille sort of reeling back. And I was like, yeah, that bug's a trigger for her. Like a weird, a surprising trigger, I guess.
I have some thoughts on that bug too, but we'll get to it.
Okay, great. We'll get to the bug.
The Bug Corner, Richard's Bug Corner, a new segment.
Please join us for Richard's Bug Corner. And if you're listening and you're an entomologist, not to be confused with an etymologist, please do write in and tell us all your bug thoughts. But the second part that this email points out is the Adora and Alan relationship, which, of course, we get a lot more of in this relationship, in this episode as well. But she says, it's not surprising that someone like Adora, who needs to feel fragile when it suits her, but is really rock hard underneath, has attracted and kept around a man who seems eager to be a silent supporter and caretaker. But the reality is that Adora is unable to reciprocate the love and care Alan shows her. He has dedicated his life to coddling her and playing second fiddle. But in the moment where he feels a sense of tenderness and looks to expand on it by staying with her, she shuts him out, literally by not letting him stay. His silent scream is a great reminder that she damages everyone she touches with her demand for love and affection that she is completely unable to return to another person. So yeah, this expansion of Alan, I'm super interested to talk about, especially in this episode. But something that I wanted to say more broadly before we get into the specifics of what we get from him here is, it's reminding me, it's so expanded from the book. And it's reminding me of what Big Little Lies did with, Adam Scott's character, this sort of like frustrated, emasculated husband of a commanding woman, and how that's explored. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tricky anytime you say, you know, particularly with a male director and in this episode, a male writer, like, where you're adapting a book about women, a story very deeply about the way women relate to one another. And you're like, but the man should be a bigger part, you know?
Right.
I think that you get into, but I think that, like that email said, and like this episode shows, in expanding Alan's, you know, sort of role in the story beyond what it is in the book, it really, what it does is tell you more about one of our central figures in Adora. So, he is still, even though he's getting a little bit more of his due, he's still in service of this, this story of women.
Yeah. And it's interesting because in the book, I think, Gillian Flynn does this really interesting thing where the men are periphery, but they're so periphery. And, I think that works really well in the book. It's just surprising how periphery the men are to the female character of the book. And I hear you. It's like, well, do we need to make room for the men, in this? If this is a female fronted show, do we make room for women all the time in male fronted shows and stuff like that? So the answer is certainly no. But, I think the way in which Alan, Vickery, Detective Dick, and I think even like Kirk Lacey are expanded in this, all serve to show how they are counterparts for our trio of main women, Emma, Adora, and Camille, and how those three are connected in terms of their relationship to men. This episode is brought to you by USA Network's limited series, The Sinner. Look out on our feed later this week as USA brings you the first installment of Still Watching The Sinner, sponsored by USA Network, in which Emma Stefanski and Matt Singer discuss the first episode of the new season, the shocking twist at the end, and everything it implies for the season ahead. After this week, you can find new episodes of Still Watching The Sinner as bonus content at the end of Still Watching Sharp Objects, as well as the next season of Still Watching. Let us get right into it. At the end of last week's episode, Camille throws the music player out the window, and we're like, yes, a tribe for Camille. This is a catharsis. Yeah. She has rid herself of a ghost. And then the episode picks up with her going to fetch the music player.
It's pretty funny because yeah. it's like one of the series' like biggest jokes so far. You know, because it's this dramatic moment and it's tethered to this, like, the whole last episode is about, you know, this flashbacks to her friend who killed herself. And then this episode is like, no, she's back on her bullshit. She's like still doing this. Nothing has changed.
Yeah. And I mean, it's very realistic, you know, like two steps forward, one steps back or whatever. Yeah. When the first time I watched the episode through, when she popped up out of the grass, I was like, did she just like get out of her car and stumble and pass out in the grass? And then I realized that she was like looking for the player. But yeah, so that means the soundtrack is back. The pressure's off DJ Alan. He doesn't have to provide our full soundtrack, though he does a pretty good job in this episode. And then we hop over to seeing both Detective Dick and Chief Vickery waking up. I really like this muttered line from Messina where he goes like, shit, still in Wind Gap, as he looks out the window and stuff like that. But then we get this like morning routine from Vickery. What did you think? Think of this moment.
It made me think of Fargo, you know, where the husband, John Carroll Lynch, is making Frances McDormand the eggs, and she's like, Prowler needs to jump, like this kind of quotidian scene of a police officer going to work. But in this case, as opposed to Marge Gunderson, in Vickery's case, we really kind of don't like him. I mean, I guess this is an attempt to humanize him. We see that he's religious. We see that, you know, he has a wife who cares for him, whatever. But his motivation and his the sort of means he employs to achieve that end, I feel like, are kind of our oppositional force in this, at least in this episode. Do you agree? Am I reading that wrong?
No, I agree with you. And I think some of the things like the religion feels to me perfunctory. You know, like he stands there. It's a thing that he does every morning, presumably. But I don't like feel it the way that like, remember when we talked about when we did the Versace episode, there's like a sequence there with a character and their religious experience. And you really feel that. And it here, it's just sort of like, okay, he looks at the crucifix because he does it every morning and has done it every morning, you know, sort of thing.
Right.
I think what's also interesting about this scenario is how it presents his wife Jocelyn as this other kind of woman in town. You know, she's positioned in contrast to Adora. She's not hyper feminine. She like gets up. She doesn't like, you know, Adora's flitting around her kitchen in heels every morning. This woman is just like, she got up. She put on some Patsy Cline. She makes him presumably this breakfast every single morning. And she's just sort of like chugging along and doing it and being nice. You know, she's like, please be safe out there, all that sort of stuff. But like, she's not the hyper feminine doll, perfect, picture perfect, thing that Adora is. And I think that the episode reminds her of her, like reminds, like Jocelyn's name gets brought up when he goes to see Adora and then again when he goes to see Jackie. So it's just sort of like, how's that wife of yours who like bolsters you up all the time, but probably you don't spend a lot of time paying any attention to her.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's very thing. True.
And then we see Adora wake up and she's mm-hmm. the fanciest lady in the whole world. And all of these characters, I think that Chris Messina gave before the season started talked about how obsessed Jean-Marc Vallée became with fans. So like, if you're playing the sharp objects drinking game, please take a sip, a responsible sip every time the camera lingers on a fan. Cause they
from your Evian water bottle.
Yes. Which is definitely has water in it and not mm-hmm. anything else. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, so we see Adora wake up, Alan is back on his record player bullshit, and then we get this, like, beginning of a really upsetting flashback to a chapter in Camille's life, which is her 15th birthday. What did you think of all the things that we see here?
You know, it's the whole beginning of this episode, minus maybe the sort of Vickery getting ready stuff, is kind of this jumpy blur between past and present. So I was a little confused about what was going on. But obviously, you know, we've established that cheer uniform, Camille is pre short hair Camille, right? Do we think that? No, or post. She's post.
I actually am not sure I know because it's post because Marion's already dead. Yeah. So it's post.
Right. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So that was one thing that confused me, but you know, it's as everything with Vallée in the show, like these dips back into memory. I like that reader who emailed and said it was, you know, it was showing what it's like to be triggered. It's very effective and it makes me immediately want to, like, you know, chase after that memory and have it fully explained, which of course, is not what this show or how memory necessarily works.
Right. So we see like Camille feeling rejected by her mom. I think Adora is like crying in Marion's room like she always does. And then we see young Alan looking like Camille's in trouble, but actually he and the family, like servant Gala, not servant, maid, whatever, have made a cake. And like, this is like a nice loving gesture, an extension of like extending of affection for Camille, which is not something that I ever imagined the big book version of Alan ever thinking of doing.
Right.
And she just hardcore rejects it. She's like, no, don't have time. I like that, you know, we talk a lot about the words that are hidden in the show. This isn't a hidden word, but I like that her cheer uniform says Cavaliers on it. Cause like that Cavaliers is like a common, like, you know, sports team mascot name, but it's also like a fun word to, you know, like, I'm sure they chose like, Cavalier. She is a little Cavalier in this moment. She's just like, I don't have time for this. And then you cut from Gala blowing out the candles to, you know, Amy Adams blowing smoke out a window, sneaking a cigarette in her bathroom. This show is so good. Like, it cuts like that are just so tremendous. Cause you don't, it does, he didn't need to do that, but he does.
No.
There's just like connective tissue everywhere. As we talked about last week, there has to be a crazy complex, bulletin board somewhere with all the like things that he's going to use to cross cut, you know.
And it should almost feel gimmicky, and yet it doesn't. Somehow it feels artful. Maybe because he uses it just sparingly enough. It's not like everything, you know. But it just feels like this little like whiff of magic or something. It's really cool.
Then we get this scene with Emma and her little hench women, her little girls, sidekicks. How would you apologize for shoving a lollipop in your sister's hair the night before?
By what Jesus would say, by shoving one in mine.
Emma decides to go with like peer pressure, like, sorry, I was showing off for my friends. But if you're playing the sharp objects drinking game, you might want to take a sip every time that, Emma says, shut up, Jodes, because that's like her, shut the fuck up, Donnie line that she has, in this series. So, you know, so she claims she's showing off her friends. They're doing like, you know, I guess what teenagers do, which is look at terrible, horrible memes about, boys who have had whose sisters have died, and there are memes circulate about them on the internet. And, you know, it looks to me like Camille is ready to forgive Emma, for this.
Yeah. And I think it's also telling that, Emma says, I was mad at you for blowing me off, which, like, Camille didn't really blow her off exactly. She just was kind of like, I'm busy, you know, like she couldn't hang out with her, you know, kid sister. And that was Emma's reaction and to this kind of like overly perceived slight. You know, it's like, it's odd, you know, it's creepy, but that like she went from zero to, you know, that angry so quickly. I don't know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the sound design on the sequence is so good because you hear the bottles clinking in Camille's bag, and it stressed me out so much, the sound of the clinking in her bag. So I was like, if they're dialing that audio up enough that like we're supposed to hear it, that means someone else is going to notice it. And I'm like preemptively embarrassed for Camille, whoever's going to like comment on the clinking bottles, that she's smuggling out in her bag. So, then we get this like, this great, like, if you thought you had seen a lot of what Alan will do for Adora, this will you please cut my food smaller scene is the next level sort of thing. So.
Well, this actually, little inside baseball, this is actually a Patty Clarkson thing. She has her meat cut for her every meal. It's just, you know, it's in her rider, whether she's on a set or not. And I respect her for it.
Have you ever had to do it for Patty Clarkson?
Oh, many, many times. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we both live in New York, so.
Right. And she's just like, Richard, please come over.
I'm happy
smaller.
To do it. You know, I'm allowed to chat with her. It's great.
But Adora begs off, hanging out with Jackie and the other women of the town because of that, scratch she got on her hand earlier. And this is like just a masterclass in passive aggression from Adora, from Patricia Clarkson, because like Camille's like, it's barely a scratch. And then Adora's like, maybe to you. And you're like, oh, wow. And then as Camille walks out, Adora says, in Wind Gap, recyclables go out on Wednesday. So good.
And there's another crushing scene later in the episode. We're really seeing like a kind of ratcheting up of Adora's cruelness. And
yeah.
You wonder, I mean, I would assume that that's because Camille now has been around for a few days. I'm a little fuzzy on the timeline, but like she's been around and like maybe things are a little more comfortable and less, you know, sort of proper. You know, Camille's feeling less and less like a guest. And so the real Adora is sort of revealing herself. And she clearly is someone who has driven her eldest daughter to a lot of strife.
Yeah. I mean, oh my God. And so Camille just does a silent sort of Alan-esque middle finger out in the hallway that her mom can't see. But, you know, it's coming. So that happens. Then we see, Vickery driving around and like the way in which like the townsfolk sort of wave to him, like his stature in the town. And then we see him looking at the stop sign again. I think the same stop sign we already see him try to fix, or maybe it's a different one, but like there's a bullet, a seemingly fresh bullet hole in this. And he's like, God damn it. Later in the episode, we'll see like who's shooting bullet holes in the stop signs in town. But what do you think of this like moment? Does it mean anything to you, or is it just to set that other thing up? Or
it feels mostly like set up. It reminds me of when I was in a tiny. Well, I was leaving a ghost town in the rural Montana one time, and driving down this like crazy dirt road down this mountain in a rainstorm, and every like there were like a couple stop signs we passed had bullet holes in them, and we were like, or they were like road signs or something, and we were for sure thought we were going to be murdered. It's kind of an ominous thing to see.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's an interesting thing though, because like the ways in which the young girls have been murdered have had nothing to do with guns, right?
No.
Like we see a number of guns in this episode, but like, you know, Anne Nash was like strangled with a clothesline. you know, and so like these girls weren't shot. So I don't know. It's interesting to like introduce that element of danger without really connecting it to the murder. Just talk about the other. It almost makes it feel like the town is such a powder keg. That's how I feel every time I see those freaking teens, those youths. I'm like, this whole place just like wants to go off, you know? But of course, and we also saw guns in the flashback with like the hunting, the boys, they're hunting rifles and stuff like that. So there's that. And then there's this like interaction between, Detective Dick and Vickery, when they're talking about John Keane. And this is like, there's a lot in this episode that I think is trying to spread the suspicion around town. There's like John Keane, there's Bob Nash, there's all this other stuff. Like, what do you think about the way in which, like, because you and I, without spoiling anything, because you and I know who the murderer is, what do you think about the way in which the show is trying to like, put up flags sort of all around town?
I mean, I think it I feel like in the text of the show, it makes sense because there are a lot of viable suspects, you know, in terms of how they were related to victims or, you know, even certain behavior. And I also think that, like, you know, even though he's been bussed in from Kansas City, Detective Dick is not, you know, Columbo, or he's not like, you know, Hercule Poirot, like, and certainly nor is Vickery. And so, like, they're going to kind of like dicker around and like try to figure stuff out, you know, and kind of like look under a lot of, you know, rocks, because, you know, it's the cases are proving hard to crack. So yeah, I think that I think the show is being fair. I don't feel like they're being overly misleading or anything, you know, just to like distract us from the real answer.
Yeah. And, you know, to further that, we get a lot of John Keane in this episode. He gets fired from Preaker Farms. Someone pointed up, so Preaker is Camille's last name because, you know, like just a little family history to clarify. Like Marion and Emma are Alan's daughters. Camille was, Adora had Camille when she was younger before she was married to Alan. And we get like a little bit more of that in their confrontation later in this episode. But like, so her last name Preaker is Adora's main name, and that's the family name. And that's why the hog farm is called like Preaker Farms or whatever. Because Krellen, which is Alan's last name, is not the like family money name, which is what Adora comes from. So yeah, so Camille Preaker Farms, that's what that's all from. We don't know who her dad is, so John gets fired, and later in the episode he sort of accuses Adora of firing him. I don't know why Adora would want to have him fired, I guess just because there's like so much suspicion sort of clouding around him. But
yeah, that was a little confusing, but you know,
just adds to his angst, his teen brooding angst. And then we get my favorite scene, and I'm not just saying that because Elizabeth Perkins is on this episode, because Jackie's here.
This feels like the perfect place for us to go to Richard's interview with Elizabeth Perkins.
Well, I'm here on the line now with Elizabeth Perkins, who plays Windgap's favorite kind of boozy floozy, Jackie O'Neill. Elizabeth, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, Jackie is such a fun character, you know, in a show, but a dark character too. And on a show that's so grim, it's really nice to have her occasional kind of cracking wit and levity. Is that fun to play?
Oh, absolutely. And yes, the show is very dark. The show is definitely sort of watching the downward spiral of a woman who's really confronting her past and all that represents to her. And Jackie is sort of like the deus ex machina that comes in and is saying, it's all going to be okay in the end, although maybe not. And sort of injects a little bit of, dare I say, humor into the situation, in that she's sort of raucous and drunk and is always offering a hug or a pat on the back. And I think it's sort of a welcome relief at times when she comes on the screen. And not because I'm playing her, But I think she offers a little bit of joy and hope.
Yeah, yeah, and that, which is necessary. And now tell me, were you familiar with this book before you kind of signed on to it? How did you come onto the project?
I wasn't familiar with Sharp Objects at all when I got the call. But I was very familiar with Gone Girl, who both of the books were written by Gillian Flynn. And of course, Gone Girl was turned into a fantastic movie. And so consequently, I went right out and bought the book and was really kind of shocked when I read it. It's one of the first times I've really seen a female heroine that, I can call Camille a heroine because she really is tackling her demons. And I think she does successfully. But it was one of the first times I saw a deeply flawed leading character study about a middle-aged woman, and was really impressed that Gillian was willing to take on those seriously dark aspects of the feminine psyche, you know, in relationship to her mother, in relationship to her sister, and more importantly, in relationship to herself. I couldn't put the book down and was very excited to get the subsequent scripts that followed that were all really beautifully put together by Gillian, Marty Noxon, and several other great people.
Yeah, it's got, the show is just kind of a dream team in terms of pedigree behind the camera as well as in front of it. And, you know, something that we've talked about on this podcast is how Jean-Marc Vallée's particular directorial style works so well for this show because he kind of, you know, flits back and forth in time with these kind of quick images, quick cuts, and it's a memory piece, so it really works for that. But when you're filming with Vallée, like, do you get a sense of that kind of collage, or does it more feel like a traditional set? Because I'm just kind of curious about how he sews this all together.
Well, there's absolutely nothing traditional about Jean-Marc Vallée's sets. And as an actor who's been doing this for a really long time, it's actually very jarring when you first get on a set with him, because it completely erases everything you've ever known about filmmaking, because he is truly organic. A lot of people will say, well, I want this to be organic. But with Jean-Marc, it's organic down to, we're not using lights. We're not rehearsing. We're not running lines. We're not blocking. I may be over there with my camera. I may be over here with my camera. I may be suddenly in the middle of your scene, be shooting a spider crawling up the wall. Your natural instinct is, as an actor, you sort of resist that until you realize that there's an enormous freedom in that. And if you can allow yourself to sort of escape into the process of that, it's a very exciting thing. For an actor to sort of have that kind of freedom. Consequently, he somehow manages in this process to really grab the environment. You know, he grabs the smell, the taste, the sound, the temperature of every place he's in. And we were shooting in southern Georgia in the middle of the summer. It was unbearably hot. And, you know, the sounds of the locusts and the people sweating, you know, that was all real. And, you know, in this episode, when you've got Camille and Richard Willis walking through the swamps, you know, looking at the crime scene and the hunting lodge, you know, that's all real. And you can feel it.
Yeah.
You can feel it in every shot. And that's really a testament to him, you know, really sticking to his process and then knowing exactly how he's going to cut it together to give you, you know, that taste. And I think it really works.
Have you watched the episodes? And if you have you been surprised by how everything came together, or had it been communicated to you kind of ahead of time? Because, you know, there's so many moving parts here in terms of all its textures and sounds and all that. So what does the final product look like?
Well, it's interesting because none of the scenes that we've done are complete in the final cutting together of the show. Everything is sort of truncated and pieced together. But it's very reflective of Camille's thought process. And everything is from Camille's point of view and through Camille's experience. So it, as an actor, you're like, wait, that scene's not, that's not the scene we did. That's not what I said. That way, I wasn't meaning that. But that's also something you let go of when you work with him, is he's going to pick a point of view and he's going to pick the story that he wants to tell. And ultimately, it's going to do justice to the story. So it is jarring sometimes to see where his camera is or what he's chosen to point out in any given scene. But ultimately, he's got a vision in his head, and there's a through line there, and that this is Camille's journey.
It really
is. The
editing
is amazing.
And in this episode in particular, there's a lot. And, so you have a couple great scenes in this episode. The first one being, you know, Adora is sort of playing sick with her cut on her hand. And so she sends Camille to this lunch, and it's you. And
I love the cut. I love the cut on the hand so much.
It's so funny.
I just love the cut on the hand. Yeah. It's the best. It's the best. And I think she says to Camille when she cuts her hand, she says, look what you made me do, or look what you did to
look
me.
What you did, yeah.
When she cuts her hand,
it's insane.
Anyway, go ahead.
So, do you have what was shooting that kind of that lunch scene like? Because you know, there's a lot of voices happening, and there's also a lot of kind of subtext happening in terms of Camille trying to act casual, but really doing some reporting work, trying to get some information about these women. So, what was the approach to the scene when you, on the day you shot it? Do you have any particular memory of it?
And what I love about the lead-in to that scene is Adora saying, you know, I'm giving them the gift that they enjoy the most, the opportunity to talk about me. And normally I don't think Camille at this point in her life would be like, oh, I'm going to go to dinner with the local Wind Gap gossips. But Camille goes knowing that she's going to get information. And she's going to get sort of what is the zeitgeist of the town and who does the town think did this? Because they're the gossip queens. And of course, they bring up Bob Nash and they bring up John Keane. And they basically say, these are our two prime suspects. And I also think that there's a relationship between Camille and Jackie that goes way, way, way back.
Yeah.
And Jackie is a very old family friend. And as the series goes on, we sort of learn that Jackie pretty much knows everything that's gone on in the house, that's going on in the house. Jackie knows everything that's going on in town. I believe Vickery comes to her at the end of this and says, what are you not telling me? She's like, I don't know anything. But she absolutely knows everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, it may have been one of the reasons that Camille got out. I mean, everything that's going on in town. I think that's one of the reasons that Camille agrees to go to the lunch. And Jackie's just numbing herself with alcohol, but the whole town is numbing themselves with alcohol. You know, Adora sort of sets the tone of, we don't talk about it. But these women talk about it amongst themselves, just like their younger counterparts, the old cheerleaders, do as well. You know, everybody's talking, but nobody's saying anything.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's a kind of, like, there's a codedness to it. You know, they're saying something, but they kind of are insinuating something else. And, you know, it's an interesting kind of way that certain, I think, small towns, small communities can operate.
Absolutely. And Adora is the queen, you know, she's the woman who lives in the big house on the hill, and everybody's under her thumb. I mean, I think we learned in this episode how jealous Henry is of her relationship with Vickery, and she basically says to Vickery, I could have you fired, and she could. You know, she runs the town. You know, it's Hog Farm and the Crowlands, and that's kind of it. And she gets John Keane fired, and she says to Vickery, I could fire you too if I want to. And Jackie knows that. I mean, she's definitely under Adora's thumb as well. Everybody's under Adora's thumb. She's a wildly wicked character and just marvelously played by Patricia Clarkson. I mean, she's just this quiet witch. It's a very wonderful portrayal. And I'm riveted by her.
I mean, everyone is, it's just a really well-acted show. Do you think that, like, in your kind of view of Jackie, is she scared of Adora? Like, do you have backstory that you create? Are you that kind of actor where you sort of need to know where your character came from? Or I'm just curious how well you know Jackie.
I think every actor creates a backstory, whether they know it or not.
Right.
And as a cast, most of the people in Wing Gap, you know, we were sort of down in Georgia for 6 weeks and we spent a lot of time like in the Holiday Inn bar, to be honest with you. And there was a lot of talk about like, well, maybe this, da, da, da. You know, we would throw stuff out at John Mark because of course this was a smaller book that was then expanded to, you know, include all 8 of these episodes. And, you know, what John Mark said to me about Jackie is, you know, that this is a very old relationship. And, why doesn't Jackie say anything? Jackie obviously knows. So why doesn't she say anything? And maybe she will. Why hasn't she? I think that's based on her relationship with Adora. You see glimpses of it later on, what they were like when they were younger. Mm-hmm. Dancing, drinking, being together. And I think there's a great love there.
Yeah, and that's such a, you know, the show in the first episode, I believe Camila's asked twice if she has children. So clearly that's such a value that this town, you know, has imposed on women in order to sort of like, you know, give them a full life or whatever. So yeah, Jackie does really stand out in the crowd among them.
No, and like eventually we come inside Jackie's house and there's a picture of herself hanging over the fireplace. So this is a woman that doesn't really have a life and definitely not a life that's been validated by the local Wind Gap gossips. I think she was instrumental in Camille leaving town. And I think, you know, Camille leaving town, you know, before all of this went down was an important backstory.
Yeah.
You know, what drove Camille out of Wind Gap in the first place? That's the story. And that's what she's coming back to confront. And this particular episode, which is called Ripe, you know, it sort of has Camille waking up in a field. That's how the episode starts. And it's the whole episode for me sort of represents the essence of Wind Gap, you know, just like the day to day sweat and smells and taste of the town, the oppression of the heat and the monotony of the fans, you know, it's all an analogy for the demons that are surfacing in Camille's experience.
Yeah, and speaking of tone, something I admire about your performance in particular, but, you know, the whole show is that, you know, we've seen this kind of boozy ladies who lunch kind of, you know, thing. Or we've seen plenty of things about small town Americans, and a lot of times they can kind of go into caricature, you know, and they can be kind of cartoony. And yeah. I think that this show and your performance don't do that. And I'm curious, how are you really conscious of trying to calibrate that, or is it just something that comes naturally, you know, but in the collaboration between actor and script and director?
Well, this is all Jean-Marc. You know, to be honest, I think Jean-Marc sets the tone. If I have a tendency to go far, it's I love comedy. And I'm like, my natural inclination is to be like, whoa, is to be hugely like large. It's just part of my personality. And it's something I enjoy doing because I'm very much an extrovert and I'm very loud. And Jean-Marc, you know, just said it's quiet. And you become sort of part of that world. And you'll notice that people are practically whispering in the show. Everything is very quiet. And so when Jackie yells out, Camille Preaker, it kind of cuts through everything. She tends to yell out. And it's why Adora says to her, you know, inside voice, Jackie. Jackie has to be restrained because everything around her is quiet and staid and methodical. And I mean, even the intonation of the way Patricia speaks, it's all very like monitored. And Jackie's just sort of like this live wire that's over there trying to kind of keep it all in check. And so she tends to be louder and she tends to be probably the broadest person in town. You know, she's got her accent. She dresses in color. And everybody else is like, Camille is one tone, and Adora is another tone. And even the teenage girls are muted. And then you get to Jackie, and she's wearing these bright blues and these reds and these yellows and these greens. And she's standing in this blue in this swamp holding a red plastic cup. You know, all those details are really important to Jean-Marc, and they mean something to him. And I think Jackie is sort of the energy that's being oppressed, you know, that kind of vibrant energy that really isn't allowed in Wingap.
Yeah, I mean, you really feel that sort of specificity in watching the show, you know. And I think it's interesting the way that that, you know, Jackie being this kind of freer spirit, similar to Camille, but also similar to the two girls we're slowly learning as the episodes unfold, similar to the two girls who were murdered. I mean, that they were kind of these outliers and everything. So the town definitely seems extremely hostile to any woman in particular who kind of veers off of the tone set by Adora, which is a really interesting kind of sociological.
That's kind of it. And, you know, later on in the episode, you know, John Keane, when he talks about the hogs, it's kind of such a metaphor where he says, you know, the pigs know what is happening to them. And that's why they shit so much. And you just go, okay, so first you said that, like, it's either the hogs or working for Adora. But Adora owns the hog farm, and these pigs know what's happening to them, and that's why they're shitting themselves. It's such a metaphor for everybody else in town that there's really no way out. So the natural jealousy towards Camille is, A, you don't have kids, B, you moved out. And I sort of imagine you've been living in St. Louis in this mansion with, you know, a really rich husband and a couple of kids. And that's not what's happening at all. But, you know, everything in this episode is really a metaphor for the smell of Wingap.
Yeah.
You know, and the oppression and why everybody is still there, you know. This is also the episode where Adora says all those horrible things to Camille, right? So she says, you know, you were so willful. You were never sweet, and I thought that you would save me, and you didn't save me. I thought that if you loved me, my mother would love me. I mean, that's all, like, deep, deep mother-daughter stuff. Deep mother-daughter stuff. And it's that scene in the middle of this episode is like, okay, now we're really heading down the Adora Camille road. You know, you really get to see in this episode who Adora really is. and the trip that she's laid on Camille. And she said to her, you know, and now you're back, and all I can think of, you smell ripe. I mean,
savage.
Wow, it's so savage.
Yeah, it's grim stuff. But I before I let you go, I'm curious about, I want to zoom out just a little bit, because for me, I know watching this show, this grim show, during a particularly grim time in America, at least for, you know, some of us, it's been a bit kind of cathartic to just kind of lean into the darkness a bit. Have you found that at all to be true, or do you see any sort of larger political dimension to the show?
Well, I do think that it's a very strange time in our country and, you know, with our president. And for me, art has always reflected politics, mm-hmm. because politics is culture. And I think this show in particular really is an examination of the underbelly. I think it's why we use hogs as a representation. And I think that that's an important study in our culture right now, is sort of this underbelly of what's really going on in this country. And I think the upcoming Calhoun Day Festival, which the women talk about at the lunch, like, well, what are we going to do about Calhoun Day? Well, everybody in town's going to be there. I think is further examination. So for me, art is an important expression, if not the most important expression of political fervor. And I think we're very representational of that. I think a lot of this is a lot of sort of the darkness that we're seeing with Handmaid's Tale and other shows, I think are necessary. I do find myself every now and then going, God, I think I want to watch an episode of Everybody Loves Raymond.
Absolutely.
Like, why don't I watch some Golden Girls? But this show in particular, I'm very proud of it. And I do think it examines a part of our culture where people are sort of afraid to be an individual. Yeah. And there's a lot of groupthink in Wind Gap that is very representational of cultures in our country right now.
Well, amidst all that groupthink and darkness, we're especially grateful to have Jackie and her bright red cup. And we're grateful to have had you on the show, Elizabeth.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. I really do.
Yeah, thanks for all your insight into the show, and we can't wait to keep watching. And, I mean, who knows? Maybe down the line we'll get a Jackie spinoff and we can talk all about that.
Yeah, Patty Clarkson and I are sort of hoping, like, the two of us have a spinoff where we just, like, argue with each other.
I would watch that 3 times a day.
So much fun. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval, variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
It's Brunch with the Ladies. What did you think of this brunch scene?
Well, I mean,
We have to first give a witch's hat, a tip of the witch's hat to beloved old Aunt Zelda from Sabrina the Teenage Witch, Beth Broderick, who appears in this scene. It was nice to see her. I mean, this scene is funny, and something that I talked to Elizabeth Perkins about is that the kind of character that Jackie is on these other Ladies Who Lunch are, that's a fun meal for an actress, and it can often sort of be cartoony or sort of inhuman and just kind of like too sozzled or too, you know, quick with the zingers and, you know, just too approaching kind of cartoonish territory. And I don't think this scene does. It's funny, and they're all a little bit outrageous, but like, I think that Perkins and everyone else kind of keeps it within the bounds of humanity, which is important for this very serious kind of grim story.
And the thing I like to watch, the thing I like about the Jackie character is like, we see her be not great to the waitstaff. And like, that's something that's like such a mark of character as far as I'm concerned. Like, you know, if you're terrible to waitstaff, I think you're probably not the best person. But I was rereading some of the Jackie scenes in the book. And one thing that Gillian Flynn says, or Camille says as the narrator is like, you know, Jackie's not like lovely, warm human, but she's always herself. And mm-hmm. So the way in which she's nice to Camille does feel genuine, because like, she genuinely, she's not just putting on a like a two-faced act or whatever. She genuinely does care about Camille. In the book, we learn that Jackie, like, you know, it was Jackie who taught Camille how to use tampons, and it was Jackie was just like a mother to Camille in a way that Adora was just unable to be. And that's their relationship. And I think you get that from like the tremendous amount of warmth, that Elizabeth Perkins gives off, even if she doesn't give it out uniformly to everyone. Like, she's terrible to this waitress for no good reason, but is warm to Camille. And, that's some nice dimensionality. She's not a sweet character, but she's specifically nice to Camille, and that that's something that Camille's so thirsty for, you know, that kind of affection, the maternal affection. And the other thing we should say is this is once again like Camille trying to figure out suspects, which she's playing the reporter. She's like, I wonder what you girls think. Like, that's some good like info digging. And they're like, oh, salacious gossip. Basically John Keane, Bob Nash feel like the two prime suspects.
And one of them says she wants to make John Keane her, like, well, she uses some phrase like boy toy, but it's something actually a little bit grosser.
I forget what it was, but it's pretty gross. And then like giggles girlishly about it. So, you know, So I really loved this brunch scene. I'm glad that Adora wasn't there so that Camille could have this moment. And we just get like some flashes of like Dick looking at the meme about John Keane. We see Bob Nash like watching all his children eat like little, like, you know, forgive me, like little piggies at the trough, like little mindless, you know, zoning out to the TV, eating their cereal, which is like no criticism of children, but like his whole thing was like, Anne was so lively and interesting and intelligent, and his other children are just like children.
Just hogs. You know? Hogs just for the slaughter.
A little hog heat action there. And then we get this insane little sketch. It surprises me not at all that Emma would be a drama kid. And
oh, clearly, yeah.
Obviously. And she and her two friends are doing this like Zeke Calhoun sketch that they put together for school. And Calhoun is like, this is a figure that gets mentioned in the books, but like is much more expanded in the show. They're doing this whole Calhoun Day thing that seems like they're leading up to. But he's a Confederate soldier that is like a, you know, so that statue in the center of town is a Confederate statue. So that's just, you know, and I think Ashley's cheer uniform says ZCHS. So it's like Zeke Calhoun High School and stuff like that. So this is like, this is the figure of their town. There's been some, like, it's interesting to me because there's been some question, I think, from people about whether or not Missouri counts as the South or like the middle of the country. But I think if you have Confederate soldiers in the middle of your town, I'm gonna call Wind Gap at least a southern town.
Yeah, and it's southeastern Missouri. There's that little kind of little like nodule on the southeastern tip of the state that kind of butts into like are the Ozarks in Arkansas. And I've seen a documentary set there. It's pretty southern in its sort of culture and view of history. But also with a sort of Midwestern kind of, I don't know, expansive poeticism kind of to it. I don't know. I haven't been to that part of the state, but, I feel comfortable calling it the South, but please still watching pod@gmail.com if you agree or disagree.
Yeah. And I mean, especially the, like Camille's, or Adora's house just feels so like Southern plantation, even though it's not a plantation, but
and
like,
she sort of a Tennessee Williams character.
Yeah.
Of.
I mean, it feels very Southern Gothic. Absolutely.
Yeah. She's like horrible Amanda Wakefield, like Wakefield, if like, like to the nth degree.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we have this interesting thing that the show has decided to do, which is make the Kirk Lacey figure, Emma's teacher. And Kirk Lacey, we talked about, we've seen him earlier in the season, like giving Camille a weird look at the funeral and then walking out of the bar when she's in the bar later, in that same episode. So I can't remember if we see his face. Yeah, we do in the flashback. Like he's involved in this memory Camille has of her 15th birthday. And so his discomfort around seeing, Camille in town, he's got this line to Emma where he says, history is history, Emma. You can't change it. You can only learn from it. So it feels like he's grappling with some bubbling remorse over his involvement in that and who he was at the time. And seeing Camille reminds him of that.
Yeah. And this is like a nice little kind of precursor to the sort of mission into the woods that Camille and Detective Dick go on, where they are, in fact, trying to learn from the past or learn from history in their own way.
Right. And this is what I mean when I talk about like this trio of relationships, because it feels like the really direct comparison is like Adora and her weird relationship with Chief Vickery, which we'll get to.
Yeah.
And then there's Camille and her burgeoning relationship with Detective Dick. So like each of these two women have their relationship with law enforcement in town, right?
Yeah.
And it's like a relationship of convenience as much as anything else in terms of them wanting to get information. But then you have Emma and her teacher, which is another position of authority, and like Emma being like obviously transgressive and like kind of Lolita-esque in the way in which she's approaching him. Don't be sad, Mr. Lacey sort of stuff. So, that's an interesting like thing that is not at all, in the book that they've sort of brought up for the show. So.
Yeah.
And then we've got another connection, which is like John Keane coming home and finding his mom passed out from the alcohol, grieving over, his sister, and this connection between John and Camille as people who lost sisters and, who have mothers who are then like incapable of mothering them. They have to mother their mothers.
There's an especially high volume of drinking in this episode, which is saying something for this show. But they really like poured on the booze for this one.
Well, yeah. And something that the show has started to do is shorthand. It reminds me actually of some of the, maybe you'll know like the technical term for this, but it's a shorthand that Edgar Wright does a lot in his, films where you just see like flashes of things and it means something. Let me further explain that. In this, you get, if you see the ringing of the bell on the store and then Camille sipping from her water bottle, that means Camille has gone to the store to buy another pint of vodka, has put it in a water bottle, is now drinking. Mm-hmm, do you know right. what I mean? Like that's,
yeah. This kind so of language. Just, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's just two shots. You just need like ring of the bell of the door, Camille swigging her plastic bottle. That's it. We know Camille's back like on the sauce again every day. So, but yeah, so as you said, we get this trip with Camille and Detective Dick into the woods, which he calls their first date. What do you think of this?
Yeah, I like it because, I mean, I like all this atmospheric family history stuff. It's really compelling. It's really interesting. But, this is also a detective story. This is a, like I said, whodunit. So I like when the show, after it's sort of really, interesting, lyrical, elliptical you know, dips back into the past, finds its sort of main center narrative again, and we get some good old fashioned exposition. Granted, that exposition is Camille talking about the past, but it is still them back on the case.
And the way in which it's, like framed, like, because you're watching the energy between Amy Adams and Chris Messina, which I like so much. And even though these are like, you know, not undamaged people and you're not like expecting there to be like some sort of storybook happy ever after, there's like, there's this fun romantic tension between them, right? Or sexual tension. And so you're watching them deliver exposition about the case while like, maybe rooting for them to kiss or whatever it is you do when you watch people with good sexual tension on a show. And so that just adds some forward momentum to this pause and this case study sort of thing. Right. So,
yeah.
Which I find very effective. But then we get this like disturbing thing. And it was even more disturbing to me in the book when Camille talks about her sexual assault, like, or whatever you want to call it. But, in the book, it's barely rates a mention. And the show is making a bit more of a meal out of it, but like that Camille on her 15th birthday in the show, basically was passed around between a bunch of, I think it's football players, as part of like a pregame ritual or whatever. They pick a lucky girl, a lucky cheerleader, whatever it is, and they pass her around. The episode never shows that exactly, but what you get instead is this really interesting shot of like Camille studying these bugs in the ground. You get these guys in like soft focus behind her, and she talks about like this ritual, and Detective Dick is like, is this you? And she's like, well, is that rape? Like, is that a double standard to call it rape? What is it? You know, et cetera. So like, what do you think of all of this? The way in which the show is treating it visually and this question of like, is Dick allowed to tell her that she's been sexually assaulted if she does not want to view it that way?
Yeah. It reminded me of another recent HBO thing with a great actress at the center, which is The Tale, the Jennifer Fox film starring Laura Dern, that I caught at Sundance, and that aired on HBO, I believe at the end of May. Which is about a woman in her adulthood looking back at a child, significantly younger than 15, like a childhood sort of sexual assault, that she at the time, she, you know, as a kind of like early adolescent, sort of lied to herself into thinking was a relationship with this older man. So the movie is all about her kind of assessing that and being sort of told by the outside world, like, no, that was assault, and she never processed it that way. So I guess it kind of raises this question, as does this scene in some sense, of like, how much of, you know, how much does perspective matter? How much does one sort of like the way that one processes that experience or classifies that experience, you know, compared to how the outside world views it? I'm not trying to say that like you can excuse away anything like this because that person didn't name it, you know, or didn't call it rape, but like, I don't know. I just think it's an interesting sort of, study in perspective or something, and certainly in memory and the power of repression and how we can delude ourselves into, softening bad things that happened to us in the past, because surely that wouldn't have, that, you know, nothing that severe happened to me.
Right. And like remembering, something that the Laura Dern, film does is, like, remembering herself at different ages, like finding out the truth and then like the past changes and all of that sort of stuff. And so I'm just interested to see like if what Camille remembers changes over the course of this episode or this season or not. And if we'll be able to notice it, because like the way in which Valet is treating memory, you know, we get these flashes of things that like are at times quite disorienting, in a way that I don't mind, but in a way that like, if there is something significant about our memory that changes, I might need some extra help visually making sure that I get that that's a different memory. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Can we also talk about something that bugged me literally? Richard's bug corner.
Yeah, bug corner.
What the fuck are those bugs? Like, do they have bugs like that in southeastern Missouri? Like, they look like Alice in Wonderland bugs, didn't it? Am I crazy?
These like crazy spotted beetles sort of thing.
They were so big and like they just look like fair, like, I don't know, something out of a children's book. It made me not want to go into the woods down in Wind Gap or anywhere nearby.
guess what? I don't think you should go to the Woods in Wind Gap anyway, to be honest with you. All that's waiting for you there is like a shack with porno and dried meat. So,
oh, my shack is there. That's right. I forgot I had my, but I bought that property.
Yeah. Your jerky and porno corner, but
yeah, with all the money I made from the Westworld podcast, you know, we're,
but so the, what I want to say about that is that if someone wants to write into stillwatchingpod@gmail.com and let us know exactly what kind of bugs those are,
Please. Yeah. Don't send us pictures though. I don't want to look at the bugs again. Just give us names.
I will read the descriptions aloud to Richard. But yeah, so we get that flashback. There's also like, you know, the triggering, aspect of the shed, which we've already seen that shed once. We see it again, like Dick, like quite wisely is like, did something happen to you in that shed? The way you did not want to go in there. Apparently that's where Anne and Natalie liked to play, like you do as children. So, and then this is followed by like their first sexual encounter, which, she adheres to the sage rules of Julia Roberts and Pretty Woman, which is no kissing, hand stuff only, and sort of takes control of the encounter in a way that like he will not be able to see any of her skin. He won't be able to see her scars in the way in which she has decided this is going to go down. So, what did you think of this?
Yeah, I thought it was handled interestingly. if only because, it's, for my count, Amy Adams' second standing manual sex scene. The first being when she, from behind, masturbated Philip Seymour Hoffman in The Master. In their bathroom.
I had forgotten about that.
Yes. So I'm glad that she's the one getting service this time.
Sure.
That's a good, and that they're looking at each other. They're at least facing each other. That feels a little more intimate. Although she's looking into the mirror in The Master anyway. But no, I think that the, I think this was well handed. I think it was, you know, there was a certain physicality to it that, felt realistically stilted and a little and awkward. Like I think a lot of times sex scenes on film, because they want them to look good, just it's like, no, I don't feel like people really like move that way or sort of, you know, it naturally sort of can read each other's minds and bodies so easily. Like I think there's a little bit of a, you know, kind of a
learning curve
sort of. Yeah, and I think yeah. So I think that the scene, which is like strange, the physicality of it is odd, makes sense because people are odd.
Yeah, I think that's right. That like, especially for a first encounter, like, Dick, as played by Messina is like, you know, sort of taken aback by this, unusual-ish request from Camille, which is like, no kissing. Let's go straight to this sort of thing. You're going to do as I say, and that's it. And the kissing thing, I wanted to sort of hop back to something I breezed past that I know that you want to talk about, which is this Tupac scene that we get just before this.
Oh yeah.
I know you tweeted about
it. Oh boy. I mean, no one told me when we started this podcast, no one told me that we would have a scene in which Patricia Clarkson sways in a kitchen, a softly lit kitchen, while Tupac's Dear Mama plays and a teenager like grasps her. It was just such an odd scene, but also, I don't know, humanizing, because you would almost think that Adora would be like, turn that off, right? But she doesn't.
Well, she'll indulge the girls like Marion and Emma, who at least present as compliant to her wishes.
Yeah.
So the way in which Emma like will dress up like a doll for Adora means that Adora will like give her affection in return. That scene triggers Camille to think about this moment where she wanted to go into her mom's room and she couldn't, but she sees Gayla, kissing her mother. And then she flashes also to Adora kissing Emma, and this idea that like probably Camille got no kisses from her mother. Yeah. And so this idea of like Adora and her kisses and the way in which that sort of splashes over into, you know, Camille not wanting to kiss, Detective Dick, at least at first, like is just one of those like quite subtle but interesting connections that didn't pop up to me, at least until like the second time through watching it. So So yeah, and so while Camille is having this lovely woodsy date, that, you know, where we talk about like rape and terrible town history and dead lesbians and all sort of stuff. Adora is entertaining a visitor, which is Vickery. This is another like impotent moment for Alan, where Alan's like, Adora's not seeing anyone, and Emma's like, yeah, forget it, come on in. And like, then he has to fetch drinks, and he says, your usual, which just implies that Vickery's over there a lot, and Alan is just shunted into this servant position. But another one of those great cuts is like, you see Camille bite into Detective Dick's shoulder as he's going to town on her, and then you see the bite mark on Alan's hand from when he was like screaming into it last week.
Mm-hmm.
And then he asks about Adora's hand, because no one's asking about Alan's hand. And he asks about her hand, and Adora's just like, and then Patricia Clarkson has this amazing line read where Vickery's looking at her hand. She goes, ow, the roses.
Yeah.
It's great. Oh, it's just so great. So what do you think of this like Vickery Adora relationship?
It's odd. And I have to say, I don't remember it being in the book. And if it's an addition, I don't really quite know that we need it, to be frank. Matt Craven's a great actor. I like his scenes with Detective Dick a lot and with, Camille. But this, I just feel like so much of the show, with some minor digressions, is interior to Camille.
Yeah.
That having this much stuff that she is not present for, involving Adora and whoever else, like, it takes me out of the heady kind of, you know, memory loop mood that Valet has so effectively created elsewhere.
Yeah, I will agree in terms of the Alan stuff in this episode. I think there's just like a little too much Alan stuff for my taste in this episode. And that's all sort of part and parcel of what you're talking about, because Alan is just like Adora at least is like, it's good to have her mood as we get this confrontation between her and Camille when Camille does come home.
Yes.
But like the extraneous Alan stuff, I'm like, I'm not sure that I need all of that, you know?
Yeah.
But so we do get this confrontation, a lot of which is sort of ripped directly from the book. Except in the book, I think she goes even harder. She says something, she says like, Camille comes home and Adora goes, I think I finally realized why I don't love you, which is something that they decided to not like swing that much for the fences in the show. But you get this like very hard scene between Adora and Camille, where Adora talks about like how Camille is a baby because she was like a teenager when she had Camille, because she didn't know how to take care of Camille. It made her feel foolish. And like a child, she says, and Camille rightly says, you were a child. And that seems to be some of the source of her anger towards Camille, is like, I thought if I was a mother, my mother would love me and you would love me. And none of that happened. And like, and dot, 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 the like, that's why I have treated you like shit your whole life. What did you think of this confrontation?
Oh, I mean, it's just like brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah, and very well acted. And, you know, I think that, you know, again, with the kind of characters becoming cartoony, I think that, I don't know, I think that hopefully this is the highest we get in terms of antagonism on the show in a way. It's been well established how people relate to one another. But I think this is about as believably human as I am willing to accept, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
The thing I liked the most about this scene is, you know, like Adora comes in for the kill, basically, is like,
yeah.
And Amy Adams allows Camille to be so vulnerable when she says like, what, mama? And she's like trembling. Mm-hmm.
God, adults calling their parents mama or some variation, like mama with an O, or just, you know, M-A-M-A. For some reason, I don't know maybe it's like some play I saw when I was a kid or something. That just like devastates me. It's the most like vulnerable, sweet, but kind of sad thing. Like this plaintive mama. I don't know.
Yeah. And then Adora says, you smell ripe. It's just like,
brutal.
Yeah, and thus giving us our episode title. I don't think we see that word on her.
No.
As opposed
Should
to
we talk episode. About Calhoun Day?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
We've not spoken about that. So this is, but this is the event to honor this, the Civil War hero or whatever, the town, you know, mascot, that Vickery wants canceled because it's going to be, you know, all of these potential suspects and all of these potential victims all kind of together. And they just think it's going to be chaos. I'm assuming that means we're going to get a Calhoun Day episode.
Yeah, I believe we are. I haven't seen it, but I think Gillian Flynn, when she was talking to me, referenced like the Calhoun episode. So I think we're going to get a Calhoun Day episode. They've been like dropping seeds for it. We've seen like posters and stuff like that. And like also Jackie talked about in this episode where she was like, yeah, all those suspects and all that, what, like young flesh crawl. So it's like something that Adora hosts at their house. Traditional thing. And this is the poster that we saw, I think, in episode one. So it is like the 50th anniversary. So this is the 50th Calhoun Day. So presumably something big is going to go down, I would guess, on Calhoun Day.
Speaking of young flesh and going down, Ashley and John have a scene together.
Our fave, Ashley, is back. Ashley giving an ineffectual hand job that John's not into.
Yeah, which is a common teenage thing.
Ineffectual hand jobs.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So John leaves. I feel so bad for Ashley. Once again, I just really love this character. You know, she like tries to get him to stay, saying like, you can like put it inside me or whatever. And then she like,
which is just like the height of like, oh God, like that's just like, you're just laying it out there.
Yeah. It's, and then she like has to like clean everything. She uses like bleach and stuff. She scrubs herself later, you know, to cleanse herself. And as opposed to like the extra Alan stuff, like I will take all extra Ashley stuff.
Yeah, the cleaning thing did confuse me. I'll admit, I wasn't sure what that was all about. It was just that she felt dirty from this encounter.
I mean, I don't know if like this is something that she does for him and she's trying to do stuff that will like cheer him up, but it's so that like makes the ineffectualness of it like all that much sadder for her. But I think in the earlier scene, in the Ladies Who Lynch scene, one of the ladies says something like, you know, perfect little Ashley Wheeler like is with this guy, you know. So it's sort of like she's not an Emma, she's not like someone who necessarily is having sex as a teenager, but like she's so desperate to try to reach John, who's so removed from her now, that she's like, you know, offering him hand jobs or sex or whatever, and then feels bad and unclean about it, is sort of my take on it. You shouldn't feel bad, Ashley. You should feel fine. Except maybe don't date John. So like John leaves, he's like, he goes out to the ball field, he's being followed, you think it's all suspicious, but we find out that he's just like going to like get a spider to replace the one that was missing from his sister's room that Camille let out. And Camille sort of rushed to get out of the house because of all the stuff that Adora said to her, goes to the bar, and she and John have a scene where, you know, they bond over having dead sisters. She lies. He asks her if she knew that his sister collected spiders, and she's like, no, which is a lie, obviously. Mm-hmm. And they have this like sort of connection. So, I don't know. Like, how are you feeling about this John Camille interaction stuff?
I'm curious to see where it's going, you know?
Yeah.
Cause it's obviously going somewhere. They wouldn't have, I feel like, the John character around quite as much if it wasn't, obviously. I think he's a good actor. And I hope that it means we get a little more Ashley.
Anything for more Ashley? A couple of things before we wrap up. Something I blew past before, which is like when the curry call that we get this week, hashtag curry call, is from chemotherapy. So it's a curry chemotherapy call. And that sort of just confirms something that you and I have been suspecting with all the medication and the coughing, which is that Curry is deeply sick and not telling Camille about it. So, that's just a little like, definitely Camille needed more sadness in her life. So there's that. Dick says something about like how the pulled teeth are indicative of someone who feels out of control and wanting to exert control. So like, I think all the stuff we get with like Alan, with John Keane, with Bob Nash, sort of feels in response to that. And so, speaking of which, we get like a bit more Alan before we go, which is Alan playing some jazz on the piano, but then also Alan putting
Riders of the Storm by The Doors on, which includes the lyrics which play over the scene, "Gotta love your man." So he's like, maybe The Doors will convince Adora that she needs to be nicer to me. But they have this weird interaction that is just like, it's so off brand for Alan from the books, because Alan from the book is like so Camille's like lapdog and so Adora's laptop, to the point where he is like tells Camille she's the problem. And in this episode you get quite the reversal, because like Adora is blaming Camille. She's like, this is all Camille's fault, and he's like, everything isn't that girl's fault and you know it. And that's not a voice of support Camille ever had in the book. So like this Alan who like puts birthday cakes together for her and defends her to Adora is like a very different Alan. We also get Alan looking at his gun, and then Alan like going into Adora's room and having his way with her, which is just like, I don't know how I feel about that at all.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's trying to further complicate the show's already plenty complicated psychosexual kind of milieu, you know? Yeah. And I feel like it's such a carefully connected system with the kind of, you know, main characters from the book and on the show, that to kind of introduce Alan into it to make a comment that maybe doesn't need to be made feels a bit like a misstep.
Yeah, I think once again, like we said with a few other things, I'm curious to see where it will all be going.
Sure. Yeah.
And so we will see. But yeah, it's not, I'm kind of like, as opposed to a lot of other elements where I'm like, yes, this added element feels like a puzzle piece that I was missing and I love having in here. This, I'm like, I'm not sure yet how this fits into everything. So I guess I'll wait and see. Two more things. One, we get one more Jackie scene, which is Vickery going up to Jackie and asking like what he doesn't know about the Preaker girl. And I think this is the sexual assault thing coming up. Like I wager you that Jackie knows about it. And like, I don't think he knows that's what he's asking about, but like, I think the reason he's asking is like Dick early in the episode was like, the Preaker woman knows something and I'm going to get it from her. And right. I feel like Vickery, in order to beat him, was like, oh, I will go straight to the source, which is Adora, and Adora will tell me. And then, I will know everything, but he doesn't get it from Adora. So he goes to Jackie. He's like, what is Adora not telling me about Camille? And then Jackie's like, you're not getting it from me either.
Yeah.
So sorry, you know.
So are we supposed to kind of connect that this thing that happened with these football players on her birthday happened in the shack, or were there two separate things?
I think at least near the shack.
Okay. Okay. Shack adjacent.
We didn't see her in the shack, but like the bug stuff could have been happening like just outside the shack, sort of.
Right.
Thing,
right. Speaking of the shack, we find out that not only were the murder girls frequenters of the shack, so was Emma.
That Emma like hung out with Anna and Natalie, and that they all hung out at the shack together. And this makes Camille worried that like Emma's the next victim. So she goes running around looking for her, and we get a bunch of weird flashes. We get like Detective Dick looking around the shack.
Yeah, it goes kind of crazy.
Yeah, we get Camille imagining that Emma has died. We get all the stuff going on. We get the Alan stuff, and then we get this final shot, which is an echo of last week's final shot, which is like Emma in the headlights, the way that like we saw Marion and poor dead Alice caught in car lights, the ghosts of them caught in car lights last week. This time it's Emma alive, caught in the car light, as one of her hoodlum friends shoots a hole in a stop sign. So there we go. The last thing I want to talk about before we get to the spoiler section, which, as I said, we will definitely be like warning you of, is my favorite shot of the episode, I think, which we did not talk about, is this one of young Camille going home and lighting one candle for herself in that cave. And just having like Sophia Lillis, the actress, like just silently give us this like girl reckoning with this thing that she does. Because like, you know, we haven't talked about like why, because Camille like went there knowing she was going to do this, right? So like, why would young cheerleader Camille do this? And like, my answer would be in pursuit of an affection she felt starved of from like at home, right?
Which is why a lot of people put themselves into certain sexual situations, you know, it's a means, it's a hope for connection. And it's too, you know, so often it ends or, you know, it turns into something, tragic and, you know, not consensual and all that. So yeah, it's this episode's a lot. I feel like this episode expands, its psychology quite a bit, even as it clarifies the literal history. So I don't know. I wonder, you know, I'll be curious to hear from viewers and, you know, whoever else, critics, whoever, how this show does on those merits, you know, like if it handles this responsibly, is this kind of exploitative? Is it, you know, or is it, you know, to compare it to The Tale, which I think really, you know, it's such a personal movie, like really does do something pretty important. I'm curious where Sharp Objects falls on that spectrum.
Yeah, and the thing I will say is that I'm actually very appreciative that the show is taking a little bit more time with this storyline, because once again, it really kind of weirded me out that in the book, it's like three lines.
Yeah.
And I think I talked in the spoiler section last week, like, though we can talk about it a bit more openly this week because I've been shown on the screen, but like, I was like, well, maybe in the book, like, the idea is that Camille has all this damage under the surface that we don't even get to, including this like teenage encounter with all these guys where she's passed around. So that's kind of effective, but I think it's even more effective the way the show is handling it, which is not to show it explicitly, but to just underline it a bit more for us, especially that like birthday cake candle shot, I think is pretty powerful. And I don't know if they're going to explore it more, if the Kirk Lacey stuff is going to become more important or not. We're about halfway through the season, so who knows? Before we head into the heart of Hog Heat spoiler territory, Richard, is there anything else you want to say about like the episode as a whole, or the fact that we're halfway through, or like what, you know, what you're feeling about everything?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, this is the first, this is the first episode in this run that I hadn't watched before. Like I watched it in preparation for this podcast, obviously, but like it was sort of one and a half viewings, and it's the episode that kind of got away from me a little bit. Like I think that maybe there was too much of the flashing or too many kind of character elements happening at once. I mean, we have Adora popping big. We have Amma popping big. We have this first sexual encounter between Detective Dick and, Camille. And I just don't know that we could, that the episode could support Alan and Vickery stuff as well. You know what I mean? This episode feels a little overstuffed to me. It feels, in fact, a little ripe. Overly right, maybe.
Maybe a little overcooked, maybe a little ambitious.
I feel like a fair word, yes.
Yeah, in all the ways in which it's trying to expand out from Camille. And maybe we want to make sure we don't lose Camille as we're just like sort of pursuing John Keane and Alan and all these other people, you know, to keep Camille at the center of everything. And I don't think we're at a danger of losing her the center of things yet. But like that is something that like could easily happen. I could see, especially given the like sort of impressionistic way in which the story is told. You know, and I've never seen like because Valet like... We've already compared this to Big Little Lies and Wild. And in Wild, it's what, like 2 hours less, right? But you're very much like in Reese Witherspoon's character's head the whole time. It's a very similar thing, but there's like never a question of like whose head we're in that whole time. Mm-hmm. In Big Little Lies, that's spread out over three to four women, you know, at any given time. This feels like sort of some sort of middle ground where like we're supposed to be so anchored in Camille's point of view. That's when the like weird words come up. That's when a lot of stuff happens, is when we're in Camille's head. But then there is this attempt to sort of broaden the story a bit more. And sometimes that's super successful and sometimes it's a little less so, I would say.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
I agree.
All right. So we are now going to do spoilers. And what, wait, Richard, remind me, what are we spoiling in the spoilers section?
Oh, the whole goddamn book.
The whole goddamn thing. All right. So
yeah, so let's blare some Dear Mama by Tupac. Maybe we'll get a refrain of that. And then it's time.
Dear Mama, maybe some pig noises. Then it's spoiler time.
Yeah.
Here we go.
make it happen, Dave. You all appreciate it.
All right. So I don't actually have a lot for the book spoiler section this time. I would say that Emma's friends, Jodes and the other one, look genuinely scared when Emma says, like, takes one to know one, when, like, one of the girls calls Kirk Lacey a freak. And Emma goes, takes one to know one. And the girls look genuinely terrified, as if to be like, shit, she could turn on us and be yanking our teeth out anytime soon. You know, sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Camille says this thing to Dick. She's like, how Wingap, when they're on their lovely first date, she says, how Wingap of you, you figure out someone's secrets to use against them later. And Dick says, no, that's not my style. But based on what happens in the book, which is like, Dick and Camille have this like pseudo relationship. She sleeps with John Keane. He finds out, then he like does sort of turn on her. I could see that line, you figure out someone's secrets to use against them later, paying off with Dick like throwing some shit in her face later. That felt like a seed to me. And then so Vickery says to Adora, one of your daughters is dangerous and one is in danger. He doesn't name which one, but I would suspect that he has the wrong daughters.
Yeah, he should flip that and reverse it.
Yeah. So those are my book moments. Not much here in Hoggy territory. Did you have anything that sort of struck you
as spoilery? No, not particularly. I am just kind of curious, like, we're now that we're halfway through, like, all right, is it ever going to start pointing toward Emma, or are we really just going to get that big clunk of a surprise at the very end? You know, I hope it's the latter in a way, because that would be more fun TV. But yeah, we'll see. I'm also like starting to wonder if like maybe they've changed some of the ending.
They could have, like, Big Little Lies, they didn't like exactly change the ending, but they changed enough of the ending where I don't know if I want to spoil Big Little Lies in the spoiler section, but like the motivation behind someone doing something at the end of the Big Little Lies adaptation is either like different or omitted enough that like it helped to have some book explanation to help understand what happened at the end of Big Little Lies season one.
Yeah.
And I would say in this, yeah, they could change stuff. I still think like what I expect, and once again, I have not seen these episodes, but like, There's a really memorable section of the book that I've seen like flashes of in the trailer, which is like basically Camille goes to a party with Emma. Maybe that happens in the next episode, because we know Camille's out there looking for Emma and Emma's out with her friends. So like if Camille is super worried about Emma, it makes a little bit more sense that she like goes to this high school party basically and gets like drunk and high with her.
Right.
And then they wind up like going home and together. And so I've seen some of that in the trailer with like the two of them sort of drunkenly making their way home.
I just had this concern with the Alan stuff. I was like, are they going to have him like kill Adora? Like when he finds out,
I thought he was going to commit suicide when I saw that gun on. I was like, is Alan going to kill himself in this episode? Like, I don't know what's going on.
I'm worried that he's going to like, it's going to be like, he finally snaps when he finds out and kills her, and it's supposed to be some sort of like justice. And I'm nervous about that.
Yeah, I don't want that. I want Adora rotting forever in jail. But I imagine, so we're going to have a party. We have four more episodes. I imagine we're going to have a party episode, the Calhoun Day episode. I would guess the Calhoun Day episode ends with Adora getting arrested, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
like on her lawn as everyone is there watching, and slow mo perp walked out of there or something like
and,
that.
Yeah, and Jackie's smiling.
Yeah, yeah.
Contemplatively.
So that's gonna happen, and then we're gonna have the like a denouement episode. That's the reveal of Emma. So like then there's just like one question mark episode in there. That would be my guess of how the season's gonna play out. But like the John Keane Detective Dick stuff, I guess, is gonna come. So
no, it's actually, there's a bottle episode with Ashley.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Is it just Ashley like cleaning all of her whites and making sure that they're like super white? Ashley cleans.
Yeah, it's just her doing stuff. And Aunt Zelda, Beth Broderick's there for a little bit. I wrote it. I wrote this. I forgot. Sorry. I should have mentioned, but, so I'm excited for that. It's episode 8. Okay, no, sorry. Episode 6. I mean,
episode 6, Ashley Bottle episode.
Yeah. Stay tuned.
All right. In the meantime, before we get to that Ashley Bottle episode, Richard, where can people find you?
You know, just vf.com, Rylaw's on Twitter. Where are you?
VF.com. Joe wrote this on Twitter. Also out in the middle of the night looking for replacement tarantulas.
No, shut up, Jodes.
All right, we'll see you next time.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
From PRX.